From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment, our relationships with and impacts upon it. I'm Chris Cherniak. Today we're rebroadcasting a couple of interviews conducted back just a few months ago. First, our interview with journalist and author Eugene Linden, who published an op-ed in the New York Times titled, How Scientists Got Climate Change So Wrong. Linden makes the case that what was once thought of as far-off worst-case scenarios have now turned out to be, in many cases, reality, leaving cities and countries with little time to prepare for the accelerating changes in weather and ocean levels. Linden states that the drive for scientific consensus and immense political pressure have contributed to the watering down of the physical, chemical, and biological impacts from a warming world. Then in the second part of the show, an article published in the Journal of Applied Ecology found evidence that biological diversity declines and pest species increase when lawns are mowed more intensely. By intensely, they mean once a week and at blade levels that leave the grass less than 3 inches in height. James Wolfen of Metro Bloom spoke with us about his research on pollinator communities that forage on lawns and his work throughout the state of Minnesota to install turf alternatives like clover that benefit pollinators while using less water, artificial fertilizer, and herbicides. A win-win-win for the environment. Those two interviews, along with some news on January 2020 being the warmest January ever recorded, and why this is significant in light of the fact that solar activity is low and El Nino activity is absent. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Well, today we're rebroadcasting a couple of interviews that we held, Nell and I held, just a few months ago. This first one is our interview with journalist and author Eugene Linden, who published an op-ed in the New York Times titled, How Scientists Got Climate Change So Wrong. Linden makes the case that what was once thought of as far-off, worst-case scenarios, things that may happen to our environment, say, 80 to 100 years from now, have turned out to be, in many cases, reality, and they may be occurring in, say, 30 or 40 years from now. And this will leave cities and countries with little time to prepare for the accelerating changes in weather and, among other things, ocean levels. Here's our interview with Eugene Linden. And joining us, a part of the show, is Eugene Linden. Eugene is a science journalist and author, and recently he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times titled, How Scientists Got Climate Change So Wrong. It was months in the making, and Linden makes the case that just 30 or maybe 40 years ago, what was once thought as a far-off worst-case scenario has now turned out to be, in some cases, quite the reality. So, Eugene, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Pleasure to be here.
So I thought we'd start with some background. Let's go back 30 or 40 years, back when, I guess, climate scientists first became enlightened, let's say, that the planet was possibly undergoing some type of warming. What was their first initial estimates of that?
Well, the first thing that needs to be said is that it's not the scientists' fault.
Okay.
Basically, global warming arose as an issue, and even as climate science was in, you know, I would say in its early adolescence, in the sense that back in the 70s when the issue first arose, and in the 80s, in the late 80s, it became a mainstream issue after that incredibly hot summer of 1988. Scientists really didn't understand, you know, the both how climate changed and how climate had changed in the past, because they lacked the tools to sort of reconstruct with extreme precision climate changes in the deep past. And so they basically were in the impossible position of having to predict what climate would do, even as they were trying to understand what climate had done in the past and how it changed. So in the So we go back to 1988 when the issue first burst upon the public, and that was that sweltering summer. After that, you know, under the UN and others sort of fostered this process, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which brought together thousands of scientists and policymakers to try and come up with an assessment of what climate change, how climate change might affect humanity in the future, right? The first assessment came out in 1990. At that point, scientists did not have the what are called the proxies to sort of understand how annual changes in climate in the, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago. What had happened is in the early 80s and through in the 70s, people understood climate to be changing at a stately pace. So that was one thing. Then, as these proxies became refined, when papers were published in 1993, they showed that no, climate doesn't change at a stately pace. That in the past, actually, you'd had extreme and rapid climate changes in a matter of decades and even years. So this was a huge reversal of the paradigm of climate change, and it really. Even after these papers were published in 1993, they didn't really percolate through to the mainstream until the late 90s. So back in 1990, the one assumption was that the climate didn't change. When climate change came, there was a lot of inertia in the system, and it wouldn't come rapidly. A second thing was, back in 1990, when the first assessment was published, everybody thought that the ice sheets were stable. In other words, that in the what's called the summary for policymakers, In the report, it basically said you don't really need to worry about the ice sheets contributing major amounts to sea level rise until 2100. Another assumption was that the permafrost was relatively stable. And one of the problem here was that there was very little data on what was going on in the permafrost. So scientists, by their nature, are data-driven and cautious about making assumptions beyond what is justified by the data. So you had three major assumptions. Climate, you know, proceeds at a stately pace. Two, that the ice sheets were stable, and so sea level would not, you know, be rising. There wouldn't be much contribution to from the great ice sheets, where most of the fresh water in the world is, to sea level rise. And then three, that the permafrost was stable and wouldn't be releasing a lot of greenhouse gases as it melted.
Right.
All of these things turned out to be wrong. Again, it was not the fault of the science. Right. Science is developing and trying to understand these things. But what happened then was that those who would delay action on climate change basically seized upon this and said, you know, what's the worry? You know, climate change is way off in the future, and it's likely to be moderate, and it's likely to come at a slow pace.
Right.
But before we jump, you know, too deep into that, I want to ask a little bit more about the data that the scientists were finding that kind of changed that paradigm of, you know, you talked about how there was this thought that climate would take hundreds of years to change. It couldn't possibly change in, you know, a decade. And then you mentioned that the kind of these ice cores extracted from the Greenland ice sheet kind of changed everything. So how did that... I don't know, how did that come onto the scientific scene in the climate change research?
Well, there were a number of projects taking ice cores from the Greenland ice sheet. There were projects run by the Europeans called the GRIP Project, and then there were projects run by the U.S., the GIS projects, Greenland Ice Sheet Project. And as they were doing this, some very inventive scientists, Willie Damsgaard being one, came up with methods of trying to take what was entombed in the memorialized in the ice cores, where there's dust, which was a proxy for the winds, because it would be dust from the Los Plateau, which is actually in Mongolia, carried there, and the amount of dust was a proxy for what the strength of the winds. And then even more clever, you would see ratios of oxygen isotopes. And these ratios could be used to reconstruct what the temperatures were at a given time. And with these new proxies, they could actually see in much more, with much greater resolution, you know, how climate changed. And there was this period about 12,000 years ago where at the end of the last ice age, there was, even as the warming was happening, a sudden cooling happened, and temperatures dropped dramatically and then stayed down for about 1,800 years or so, and then rose just as dramatically. Well, when that period was first discovered, because the resolution of the proxies was so imprecise, this was back in the 70s and 60s and 70s, the notion that the climate changed that rapidly was kind of dismissed as a regional thing. It had to do with regional factors, wasn't a global phenomenon, and it wasn't really, and also the data could, because of the poor resolution, could be kind of put aside. As these proxies got better, it became ever more clear that the climate change that happened during this period called the Younger Dryas, was extreme and rapid. And then so there's kind of a structural lag built into science. In other words, you design an experiment or a project, you spend a year or two or more collecting data, then you have to analyze the data, and then you have to publish the data, and it gets peer-reviewed. And so, you know, the data from the Greenland ice sheets, which was collected in the late 80s, was actually not published until 1993. And it hit the scientific community as a complete shock. In fact, I quote a science historian in the piece as saying that the day when everybody realized that rapid climate change was something real was the day they saw those papers. But then, of course, once the scientific community changes, it still has to percolate into the broader community. And that's actually, I would say, if you did polling today about whether climate changes rapidly or slowly in the general public, most people would still say slowly.
We're speaking with Eugene Linden. He's a science journalist and novelist, and he recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times titled How Scientists Got Climate Change So Wrong. I wanted to continue that thought, because you say in your op-ed, science is a process of discovery. It can move slowly as the pieces of a puzzle fall together and scientists refine their investigative tools. But in the case of climate, this deliberation has been accompanied by inertia born of bureaucratic caution and politics, and this can have severe consequences. And so talk a little more about that and the idea how, you know, science is also a process of consensus too, but consensus can kind of dilute findings in a way.
Yeah, that's exactly the point of this piece, frankly. In other words, scientists are cautious. They're not going to go beyond the data.
Right.
And this unwieldy group of 5,000 scientists and policymakers are part of the group. So on the one hand, you had, you know, let's try and find the consensus of what climate change is. We're talking about in the early 90s. And then on the other hand, you have policymakers who are to some degree who are part of the process, and many of them representing governments who really don't want to take action on climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And to a degree, they're putting their thumb on the scale. And so keep in mind that you have a consensus document, and then there is a summary for policymakers, which is all anybody is going to read outside of the scientific community, by the way. And so there was huge pressure not to really go beyond what was minimally acceptable. And so it's mm-hmm. consensus documents by their nature are somewhat, you know, cautious. And then you had policymakers involved, and they're cautious. And then you had national governments involved, you know, who really didn't want to be boxed into a corner. And so what we ended up with documents, even though there were scientists and, you know, sometimes significant numbers of scientists who actually really suspected the permafrost was going to be melting in the next 100 years and that the ice sheets might not be as stable as the consensus document held out, and that climate change might be more rapid. The consensus that showed up in the reports was much more moderate, and that was a real problem. I mean, one of the reasons we're in the state we are today is that there was a lack of urgency back then when we might have done something about it. And the lack of urgency, I can give you a perfect example of this. The first assessment produced these somewhat modest implications for future climate change.
Mm-hmm.
a well-known economist, William Nordhaus of Yale, decided he was going to model how climate change might impact the economy. What he had to go on was, of course, that first document, which represented the scientific consensus. And the assumption back then was the oceans would absorb a lot of the, heat, and so that, you know, climate change when it came would be, you know, way off in the future and somewhat moderate. In a 1993 paper, he estimated that the impact to the U.S. economy in 2100, based on what the IPCC was saying in 1990, would be 0.5% of GDP. No one is going to jump out of their chair and say we got to do something if over 100 years out the impact is going to be 0.5% of GDP, particularly when it meant a radical transformation of our energy infrastructure and that sort of thing. And so, and here's the second example. Sea level rise has been one of the most, the potential for future sea level rise has been one of the most contentious issues in all the IPCC reports. And one of the major issues is how much of the ice sheet's going to contribute. Well, when I was in Antarctica in 1995, there was some concern that these ice streams, which are literally streams of ice within the great ice sheets, were accelerating. And these ice streams move ice from the interior of the ice sheet towards the glaciers and the coast, on the coast, and then they go into the ocean, right? So if they're accelerating, that means more ice going into the ocean and potentially raising sea level rise. But this was not mainstream thought at that point. But even then, they were probably contributing to sea level rise. Because there were no true empirical studies, even as late as the early 2000s, in the 2007 assessment, they do these assessments every 5 years or so, in the 2007 assessment, it did not include any estimations of sea level rise being accelerated by contribution from the ice sheets, even though at that point, the ice sheets were probably contributing something like 20 to 30% of sea level rise. This caused a huge blow up within the IPCC because a lot of scientists knew that the ice sheets were actually contributing something to sea level rise. But the thing that was published showed a worst case scenario for sea level rise of something like 0.59 meter by 2100.
Wow.
Following that, I think, and probably because of that, the IPCC started catching up in terms of in terms of the contribution to the ice sheets, both to the rate of sea level rise and to how far seas are likely to rise by 2100, you know, and then by 2013, they'd actually upped the worst case scenario by about 60%, and even the mid case scenario is up by a significant percentage as well. So it gives you an idea, you know, of how caution in the policy community can impact the science, even when the scientists know that something else is going on.
So, yeah, kind of along those lines, I wanted to ask, you know, like outside of the concerns about, you know, scientific consensus, how much has political pressure and sort of that fear of being called an alarmist impacted the way that scientists have reported their results and communicated them?
Well, I think because of the heat that scientists have gotten, it would be human nature not to do a little bit of self-censorship. To their credit, most scientists don't. And I think they've become emboldened. There have been some heroic, for instance, Michael Mann, who is a very well-known climate scientist, was vilified for some emails that came to light that were misinterpreted to indicate that somehow the scientists were fixing data. They weren't. I mean, they were just using statistical adjustments. And it just was. And ultimately, he was completely exonerated of any charge of tampering with the science, as well he should have been. But he was attacked and basically driven out of the state of Virginia by the attorney general, you know, who was, you know, and then who launched investigations into state funding of the climate science and things like that. So there's been a climate of intimidation that a lot of the scientists have had to deal with. I do think that it is, you know, made it very much less likely that any scientist is going to push for an aggressive interpretation of the data, given that this reaction and the, you know, these trolls are out there, you know, waiting to jump on any indication of bias in the science. So it has an impact, a psychological impact. And look, we're in a fix right now. There's a reason we're in the fix. And I think the reason we're in the fix is, that, again, the lack of urgency in the 1990s. And that was a product of both having to invent the science in real time and those who cleverly exploited uncertainties in science to imply that there was less unanimity in the scientific community about the threat than there was. We lost a decade. We lost probably lost two decades. If you go back, Jimmy Carter convened a panel to study climate change in the late 70s.
Wow.
And they came out with a recommendation saying that, gee, if we don't do something about this, we're going to see changes in the climate before 2000. Actually, they were already seeing changes in the climate, so they were too conservative. But then Reagan was elected, and he had absolutely no interest in, you know, doing anything that might affect the extraction of fossil fuels and the use of fossil fuels. And so we've really lost a decade, except on the scientific side there. But in terms of public awareness, we lost a decade.
Right.
Then 88 came along, and interest spiked. Again, the lobbying efforts by both manufacturing and the rail companies and which carried the coal and the fossil fuel lobby had a very successful disinformation campaign that kind of diffused a sense of urgency.
Right.
And, you know, if you look back, climate change has not been a voting issue. It's not that it wasn't a voting issue in the 90s. Al Gore did not campaign on the issue particularly because, you know, I think the cynical appraisal of the public, you know, wasn't going to vote on the issue was right. No president really campaigned on the issue. And then finally, Obama does something with the Paris Accords in his second term when he no longer has to face the voters. That tells you all you need to know about the sort of public apathy on the issue, even though they are aware of the problem. Few people see it as their problem right now.
Yeah, and just in a few minutes we have, it seems like, and now here we are 2020, in effect, it seems like the science has caught up, scientists have caught up to the rate of change that's occurring. Let's say environmental economists are caught up in trying to identify the impacts. So we're having a much more robust conversation about what's happening, the resiliency that's going to be necessary, the mitigation that's going to be necessary. But now we have an administration that is, once again, completely disinterested in even having a conversation about this.
Well, disinterested is giving them credit. I think they're hostile. You know, I mean, we pull out of the Paris Accords, you know, fighting the fuel emission standards for cars. In every turn, they're trying to roll back the clock and bolster fossil fuel. So it's not just disinterested. It's something more aggressive. But it is a period of extreme, rapid change in public attitudes, I think, right now. Mainly because climate change is beginning to cost people money. This notion of climate redlining, where if you live in a fire zone in the West or in a flood zone in the Southeast, you're having a harder time getting insurance. You can't get insurance. You can't get a mortgage.
Right.
You can't sell your house if the buyer can't get insurance, or if the insurance is too expensive, they're going to pay less. And so it's having an economic impact. And that is, you know, whether or not you believe in climate change, if you can't sell your house because sea level is rising and storm surges and king tides are basically flooding your property, it's, you know, you're going to be feeling the impacts of climate change. And
right.
as people understand this, I think we see a very rapid change in public attitudes right now.
Eugene Linden is a science journalist and novelist and the author of the November 8th New York Times op-ed, How Scientists Got Climate Change So Wrong. It's a great piece. It's still available online, but you can't comment on it because you know why? Because they're all full up of cut off any more comments. 2,100 comments is the most it'll take.
The max.
And that's what Eugene got. And we could probably spend the next half hour talking about those comments. But we got to go. Thank you so much, Eugene, for taking the time. Hey, do you have a website you want to...
I do, eugenelinden.com. And I've sort of posted some expanded thoughts on this issue on the website, so anybody who's interested, welcome to go there.
All right, thank you. That's L-I-N-D-E-N, Linden. Eugene, thanks again so much for taking the time to chat with us this morning on This Green Earth. This second interview is based on an article published in the Journal of Applied Ecology that found evidence that biological diversity declines and pest species increase when lawns are mowed more intensely. This is an interview we had with James Wolfen of Metro Blooms. Here it is.
I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the show today is James Wolfen of Metro Blooms. And he's here to talk with us about his research on pollinator communities and lawns and a program that Minnesota has put in place to help address the issues related with this. So, James, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me on.
So let's start with this. I want to talk a little bit about your research because I think it kind of lays the groundwork for why these programs are important or why these programs to put in place turf alternatives really matter. So tell us about the research that you recently completed.
Yeah, so my research or the research project as a whole goes back to the University of Minnesota, where my two research advisors, Drs. Marla Spivak and Dr. Eric Watkins, they wanted to take an alternative approach to how we manage lawns. So traditionally, lawns are managed for aesthetics, where you just want this manicured green surface. And what they viewed is that in many cities, many urban and suburban areas, the lawn is kind of the largest green space. And they want to see how we can alternatively manage these areas to support the diversity and provide forage for our pollinators. So this started with a different graduate student. His name is Ian Lane, and he asked a very simple question. What low-growing flowers can we grow in a lawn setting to promote bee diversity? Kind of what flowers can grow alongside the turf? So he isolated the flowers that were best suited for a lawn setting, and then I came in and I looked at two different settings. So one, the value of naturally occurring lawn flowers to bees, and two, what happens if we artificially or intentionally introduce flowers to a lawn to support bee diversity.
So, James, can I jump in and ask, what are the those flowers that were being specifically looked at that were isolated when we say naturally occurring lawn flowers?
Yeah, so we were looking at one flower specifically. That was Dutch white clover. And the reason that we use that flower is because it is just so common in our yards, and there's this misconception that this flower is a weed, or at least, in my opinion, a misconception that this flower is a weed.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go across any lawn in Minnesota, I know in my home state of New York it's commonly occurring, you'll see Dutch white clover in almost every lawn. The only exception to that would be if there's a homeowner or some land manager that's actively treating against it. And we really want to show land managers, we want to show homeowners, just the community on the whole, that if you instead view this flower as a source of forage and really look at the incredible diversity of bees that use this flower as a source of forage, we can kind of alter perceptions. It can really change how people view this flower. And what we found for Dutch white clover alone was pretty incredible, at least in my opinion, where we saw over 50 species of bees that use Dutch white clover as a source of forage. And that number of 50-plus species is almost 20% of the total bees that are present in the state of Minnesota.
Wow. So Dutch white clover, I want to focus on that for a bit. And obviously the question is that something that might grow in this environment? We certainly grow our share of bluegrass, Kentucky bluegrass. So we can grow grass here. Can we grow Dutch white clover or a clover that's similar to it? Any sense of that?
Oh, I would bet that Dutch white clover is in your lawns and you just don't realize it already. It's that little white flower, only 2, 3, or 4 inches off the ground.
Mm.
And if you, you know, take time to look a little closer at it, you'll probably see bees all over it.
Okay.
All right.
All right. So then this is going to get mowed periodically. So clover can withstand, you know, typical maintenance of lawn like that?
Yeah. So search plots I used were mowed once every 10 to 14 days. They were mowed just by the local park service. And every time I came back to my research site, the flowers grow back fast enough where, as long as it wasn't, you know, 1 or 2 days after a mowing event, there was already blooms.
Right.
So the flower blooms as low as 1.5 or 2 inches off the ground, which is lower than even most mowers are set to.
Hmm.
So as long as you're not doing, you know, a mow of 1 or lower inches off the ground, you should have clover blooms at pretty much all times.
Okay.
So then you also looked at lawns that were seeded with wildflower, right?
Yeah, and we kind of wanted to bring two different populations into the fold. So when I was looking specifically at Dutch white clover, it was kind of for that homeowner who doesn't really have an emotional or a personal investment in it. It's just, if you do nothing and just let the flowers go, what happens? With those floral enhancements where we were intentionally seeding flowers into the lawn, then we were kind of targeting those communities that want to make an active, that are really striving to improve their ecological environments, that want to make an active effort and a little bit of a, put some funds towards supporting those bees, supporting wildlife on the whole, and saying, if you purchase some seed to just sprinkle over your lawn, so you just apply it as an overseeding, then what happens to your bee diversity?
Hmm.
You see more bees than just if you had just what Dutch white clover alone, or are the bee communities mostly the same? And we did see that if you intentionally introduced new flowers to the lawn, there were more bees, there were different species that we weren't seeing before, and just a healthier bee community on the whole.
Again, these are flowers, other plants that can be periodically mowed and will return.
Yeah, so that was actually, so floral selection, which was done by a previous student whose name is Ian Lane, that was probably one of the most difficult parts of this project on the whole, was
right. Determining
what flowers are appropriate for a lawn setting. So we wanted all flowers that bloomed at 2.5 inches or lower.
Okay.
Got it.
So then it becomes compatible with the lawnmower.
So exactly. If we were trying to use flowers that bloomed at 8 inches, 12 inches, 18 inches off the ground,
right,
then it's no longer that traditional lawn aesthetic that we're associated with. Then you have more of a native prairie in your yard. So we wanted to allow people to have that traditional lawn recreation, that traditional lawn activity that they're used to, even a little bit of that traditional lawn aesthetic, but just also incorporate some flowering plants that your bees will thank you for including.
So then some surprising things happen when you release this research, right? This kind of led to a statewide initiative.
Yeah. So in Minnesota, we're lucky enough to have what's called this Pollinator Task Force, who was appointed by former Governor Dayton, where he set up some of the great researchers in our state. So my advisor, or I guess now my former advisor, Dr. Marlowe, that being one of them, they were set to kind of put together some sort of policies that they thought would improve the state of bees or the state of pollinators in the state of Minnesota. And the very first proposal to come out of that was what we're calling the Lawn to Legumes Bill. And what that does is it provides $900,000 to homeowners or residents that want to convert some part of their yard or the entirety of their yard to some bee-friendly, some pollinator-friendly lawn alternative. So that can be a bee lawn like I studied, but that's really just one component of it. It can also support a rain garden. It can support what we call a native pocket planting, which is just like a small native garden bed in your yard. So it can go towards a lot of different pollinator-friendly planting.
I mean, that's incredible. Almost $1 million, I guess, a year now coming to this. And what's the response been like so far?
Yeah, the response has been overwhelmingly positive. So when this bill got passed, it was covered from everything from the Washington Post to our local CBS and Fox News subsidiaries. It was even on the front page of Reddit.com, which was exciting for me personally. and we just recently opened applications. I believe it was right in the start of January, and within the first week of opening our applications for this program, we received enough interest, enough applications, where we could have theoretically gone through all the funding just from those first batches of applicants alone. Because we want to have some geographic equity and allow more people to access the program, we are going to keep the funding open for longer than that. We also want to be able to show our politicians, our legislature, that there is very high demand for this, that Minnesotans really support this program. So for us, a successful program is getting as many applications as we can possibly bring in.
Hey, I want to get back to some of the, let's call it the mechanics of making this work, having a clover and grass-based setting. Again, up here, I'm gonna use, you know, Park City's high desert environment as its example. Here we have to water, probably apply about an inch to an inch and a half a week to make Kentucky bluegrass green, keep it green, and growing. Also add fertilizer, of course, and occasionally, at least in my, where I live, you know, the property managers are applying some herbicides and maybe a pesticide or two. Again, is there, are plants like clover and these other small blooming, short blooming flowers amenable to watering and fertilization and chemical applications that Kentucky bluegrass requires?
Yeah, so these lawn management practices or inputs that you discussed, irrigation, fertilizer application, mowing, etc., those will all...
Excuse the noise, we're in a construction zone here.
The duck white clover, the self-heal, the creeping thyme. The only one that would be an exception to that would be the application of herbicides, especially broad-spectrum herbicides.
Right.
So if you were to apply something like a glyphosate, then the flowers would not be able to survive through that. But all of those other applications or inputs that you mentioned, those would be just fine with the flowers that we utilized.
Okay. All right. That's good. So obviously, yeah, the Roundups of the world, not good for these
correct,
types of plants.
Correct.
Okay.
And I think especially at a residential level, we're starting to see homeowners use those products less and less.
Yeah, I agree. How about, and we've been talking about bees, but there are other pollinator species that probably benefit from these low blooming flowers, butterflies or so, or maybe even a hummingbird or two.
Yeah, so I didn't see any hummingbirds, but I saw a lot of hemipterans, so those little, they're called true bugs with the sucking mouth parts. We saw a lot of those. I saw some butterflies and moths as well. And actually, through the statewide program, we are making an active effort to use some monarch-friendly flowers. And if it's going to be used by the monarch, it'll be used by other butterflies and moths as well. So some examples of that are world milkweed and butterfly milkweed. So I'm sure many of the individuals in your community, especially those with a more ecological focus, know that association between milkweed and monarchs.
Mm-hmm.
But what they might not realize is that milkweed is also great for bees. And there's some really great research out of the University of Kentucky that shows those two species in particular, world and butterfly milkweed, both support the monarch caterpillars. And they support a great diversity of native bees.
So taking kind of a step even further back, why is it important to have pollinators in your yard? I think sometimes those of us that think about this a lot, you know, that's a natural leap. But why do we care that we have, you know, 50 species of bees using our Dutch white clover? Or why do we care that we want even, you know, a larger diversity of pollinators and bees around in our communities?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I would say there's a lot of benefits, and a lot of them are context-dependent. So if you're in a more rural, kind of ag-focused landscape, and you make this change to your yard area, then you're really supporting your kind of big agricultural growers near you. So any sort of vegetable and fruit farmers and growers. But since a lot of this is being applied in urban and suburban areas as well, I do like to focus on those benefits as well. So any sort of local garden, any sort of local food production is going to greatly benefit by an increase in pollinator diversity. If you just think about your local ecosystems, your local landscapes, the trees and shrubs and naturally occurring flowers, most of those are also insect pollinated, and the most common pollinators of those would be your bees. and also just supporting different trophic levels, so supporting different biological. When you support your bees, you're supporting first the lower, even lower trophic level, that vegetation, but also your birds, your small mammals, etc., all of those higher trophic levels that see insects and pollinators as source of their food. So it's kind of, you know, you make one difference for one animal group, but it's repercussions up and down trophic levels.
Yeah, I always look at grass, the traditional monolithic Kentucky bluegrass setting as flyover country. If you're a bee,
it's a pollinator desert.
Like, there's nothing here for me. You know, I'm going somewhere where there's more biodiversity. So it's just flyover country for them. I'm also curious about carbon uptake. You know, we're trying to be a net zero carbon community here. Is there any research that might suggest that a lawn that has lawn flowers or has more biodiversity to it has greater carbon uptake capacity than just a monolithic Kentucky bluegrass lawn?
So I can't speak to the exact comparisons of the species that were used in pollinator lawns versus a typical turf grass lawn,
mm-hmm.
but on the whole, in general, most other sources of vegetation do have a greater net positive impact in that regard.
Hmm.
I mean, and for that state program where the types of plantings we're using are much more diverse than just the pollinator lawn. So also included in that is pollinator beneficial trees and shrubs. Anytime that you're incorporating a tree or a shrub, then you're definitely going to see a net positive impact with relative to Kentucky bluegrass.
Okay. That's encouraging. It's just another motivating factor for us to try to improve our biodiversity in our lawns.
It is, and I think it's so inspiring because it's something we can do so easily right at home.
Right.
Throw some wildflower seed out, or even less than that, just don't use herbicide so that these, you know, naturally occurring flowers can bloom in our yards. I love that.
And maybe have it, Nell and I are talking now. Maybe have a set aside, if, again, like where I live, we have acres of Kentucky bluegrass around. Maybe set aside a portion of that setting to just no-mow zone and experiment with that and just plant wild flowers or seed it, and let's see how that unfolds over the course of time. Experiment a bit and then evaluate that over the year. So we're just riffing here about how we can apply this here and get people to grow less grass.
Well, James, I think that your research on this is, again, it's really inspiring. Are there other folks doing similar research out there right now?
Yeah, it's actually becoming more and more popular, which is very exciting in my opinion. So out at UMass Amherst, so over on the East Coast, there's two researchers there who've actually been doing this research and been publishing papers. The last names are Lerman and Malam. And they look at everything from what bees are using flowers in lawns to how does mowing frequency affect the number of flowers, the abundance and diversity of flowers that you see in a lawn area. You mentioned Watson, who I believe is out of Quebec, who just published that really high-impact paper, which was more of a meta-analysis of kind of just looking at what happens to insects and flowering plants when you just simply mow less. And Watson has done other great research. Jonathan Larson out of, I believe he started out at either the University of Kentucky or the University of Purdue, his master's work at the University of Kentucky. He asked a similar question to me, but he was more focused on those naturally occurring flowers. He is kind of one of those pioneers of white clover is a flower, it's not a weed. He also did the same for, what was the other species he did it for? Oh, dandelion, of course, yeah. So he looked at dandelion and Dutch white clover. So there's kind of a lot of these pioneers who keep popping up through the woodwork saying, let's just take another look at how we look at flowers and view them as something that's good for bees rather than a nuisance in our yard. One of the things that I always say at all my talks is, I still don't understand how people were convinced that boring manicured green grass is prettier than a bed of flowers.
You know, we were just talking about this before the show, James.
Yeah.
How did that get started? Why is that our vision of perfection?
That's good marketing by Scott's Turf Builder.
Yeah.
So we are.
I didn't want to go that direction.
I will.
If you can make a buck off of it.
Well,
that's their point
right. And now we've got to change behaviors. This is all about changing behaviors.
Again, well, and I'm glad you mentioned dandelions because I had actually meant to ask about that. That's obviously one of our, you know, most frequent lawn flowers. And are we seeing a benefit of dandelions as well to our local pollinators?
Yeah, so dandelion is definitely a pollinator-friendly species. One thing that's really great about dandelion is it blooms really early in the season when there's fewer resources available. The only reason that I didn't include it in the seed mix that I used was one of the things you mentioned was changing behaviors. And for some reason with dandelion, when a resident or a homeowner sees that seed head, some just have it, this irrational hate for it that I'll never understand. But we feared that if we included dandelion in the seed mix, it would decrease the likelihood that homeowners and residents would be willing to adopt this practice and implement these beelons. They'd see that dandelion was listed, they would envision that seed head, and they would toss the program aside and look the other way.
Right.
But sure.
If you don't mind that little seed head, then dandelion's great for bees, absolutely.
And right, I think we've talked about this in the past, that in the early part of the season here, spring, a beekeeper told me dandelion is the primary source of pollen and nectar or so for bees up here in the spring. You know, and that goes through basically June. So it's an important source of food for bees. Now, the challenge with dandelions, though, is that their head is greater than 2.5 inches, right? So they're going to get mowed. We need to find a dandelion species that doesn't grow as high.
I think they'll grow below 2.5 inches.
You think so?
Yeah.
We can get them to do
I
that?
I do. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And lots of people mow. So we'd use 2.5 to be kind of on the conservative side, but it's more common for people to mow at, you know, to let their lawn grow out to 3, 3.5, 4 inches. And really, you know, the lazier the lawnmower, the lazier the land manager, the more friendly you're being to your pollinators. So even if you cut down to 2.5, once you start letting it grow out to 3.5, 4 inches, then there's plenty of room for those dandelions to get in.
I like it. The lazy lawn.
That's right.
There's our term. We need to grow a more lazy lawns.
Well,
yeah,
James,
it's kind of nice where, to an extent, the less you care about your lawn and the less money you throw at it and the less you try and keep that perfectly manicured kind of look, the more friendly you're being to your bees. So
right.
I don't mind the lazy lawnmower approach or the lazy land manager approach when it comes to a lawn.
Well, I'm ready to hop on board with this philosophy, James.
Only 4 months from now.
A mere 4 months from now. We have to kind of wrap up our time here, but I did want to ask, you know, what do you recommend as some resources for people who are thinking about doing some of this, maybe making some shifts on their own landscape?
Yeah, so this Lawn Leggings program is a state-run program led by our Board of Water and Soil Resources. And one of the things that they're doing that I am very excited about is, in addition to offering this funding, a great deal of that money has gone towards, so that $900,000 has gone towards the development of DIY, do-it-yourself resources for homeowners and land managers, creating publicly available webinars. So even though this is a Minnesota-funded program, all it costs for a bag of clover is $7, and that $7 will get you enough clover to share with you, all your neighbors, all your neighbors' friends. So if you're a self-motivated land manager, homeowner, resident that wants something beneficial for your bees, those DIY resources available on the Bowser page, just BWSR, will go a long way in helping you think about the different planting types that are the best option for you, depending on how much time you want to spend in your yard, how much financial flexibility you kind of have to go towards a lawn planting, and anything from a rain garden where you also want to do some water conservation work to a simple BeLon, there's so many options that are available through this great DIY info.
And tell us again where we can find it. What's that website?
Yeah, so it's the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. Uh-huh. So just if you type in MNBWSR on your Google search bar, that'll do the trick.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning. That's James Wolfen with Metro Blooms.
There you go. There you have it. Lazy lawn. This summer, this spring, let's plant clover instead of Kentucky bluegrass and make our honeybees and bumblebees and butterflies and yourselves much happier. You're listening to This Green Earth. I got another minute or so, but I want to get this news item in. This from Jeff Masters, who writes for Scientific American. January 2020 was the planet's warmest January since record-keeping began in 1880. This according to NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information. Global ocean temperatures during January 2020 were the second warmest on record, and global land temperatures were the warmest on record for the month of January. Impressively, the warmth of January 2020 came without an El Niño event being present. Furthermore, we are also near the nadir of one of the least active solar cycles in the past century, a time when it is more difficult to set global heat records due to the reduced amount of solar energy Earth receives. Thus, the remarkable warmth of January 2020, says Jeff Masters, is a strong reminder that human-caused global warming is the primary driver of our warming climate.